Álgido. I was waking up to this violent noise. It was a horrendous noise, and then this violent shaking. You couldn't hear yourself speak. It was just so noisy, and we were just hanging on to our bed to stay in it. And I think initially that would be the first thing that you would hear.
What time of the day was that?
Oh, 5 o'clock in the morning.
Did you realise it was an earthquake straight away?
Yes, but yes, it was so noisy and so loud that, you know, I've never experienced anything like it before or since.
What was the next thing you did?
Well, we just stayed in bed because it was pitch dark, and of course there was no lights and everything was, you know, there just didn't seem any points. And then that we had our neighbours, we were in bed and our neighbours were banging, we had neighbours right next door to us, and they were banging on the window asking us if we were all right. And it suddenly occurred to us that, goodness, you know, this you know, people could be hurt in such a violent situation.
How so violent was the actual movement, though, when you were in bed?
Oh, well, you had to hang on to the bed to stay in it, because we would be right on top of the Anangahua earthquake, right practically on top of the fault itself. So it was quite violent in our house.
So in the house itself, were things falling off the shelves,
yes,
and so on?
But the noise was so horrendous that you didn't couldn't hear anything falling over. Our fridge, for example, in those days, fridges were pretty weighty affairs, and it was right. It had been thrown over and was lying face down on the floor. Our sofa, you know, a heavy sofa, three-seater sofa, was flipped over because we had the S waves. You know, they're the ones that throw you underneath, come up from underneath, and they just threw everything out of cupboards. And my husband sort of, when our neighbours were shouting out to us, he sort of raced outside to sort of say, "Well, yes, I'm right." And he ran over all these broken preserves, but he didn't cut himself. And the next morning, when we looked, well, when it was daylight, we sort of looked and were amazed at what he'd walked over, but hadn't sort of injured himself.
How did you find out about how much damage there was and what needed to be done? How did that happen?
Well, once we got dressed and went down to the crossroads, and we lived on the State Highway 69, and just, or say 400 yards down from us was the crossroads. And at the crossroads we had a hotel, a post office and a shop. And everybody was and there was a number of houses all down there as well. So we wandered down, that seemed to be where we would find people. And when we got there, everybody was in their night attire. Some of them wore blankets ripped with a hole in the middle, in sort of Indian style. And in the middle of the road was a Vela heater. I don't really remember what the Vela heater did other than sort of burn fuel, but everybody was standing around it, trying to get warm. And beside us was the hotel, so people nipped in and got a bottle of brandy and whiskey, and these bottles were being handed around, and people just took a wee swig and handed on, and we were all sort of talking about how it had affected us. You know, some people, one family had been lucky in rescuing a child just before a chimney fell on their cot, and so they just grabbed the baby out in time.
What actually happens once you get people together, in this case around the heater in the middle of the road, having a sort of a bracer just to sort of steady themselves? At what stage does someone start to say, "Well, look, let's get organised"? Did something happen that meant that you...
Well, daylight. While it was dark, nobody sort of... There was no point in going anywhere because, for one, the roads were... they were both... You know, the roads were all broken up, and asphalt had great cracks and holes. Telephone and, you know, wiring was all power wires and things were, you know, they were all over the roads, and so it wasn't really safe to move about until you could see around you. And of course we were still getting earthquakes, what I mean is, and people really wanted to be together. Nobody wanted to sort of be by themselves.
And I suppose there was nowhere you could go either, was there?
Well, no, nobody wanted to go into their houses because there was things falling. What I mean is, you know, cupboards flew open, and literally the whole contents just flew out onto the floor. So you didn't want to be anywhere near a, you know, in a house because things were falling out of it, you know, falling out of them, and you didn't want to sort of be by yourself. Once daylight came, Warren and I went over to Warren's parents' place. His grandmother was alive in those days too, and she was outside. She'd taken her fireplace out of the house and had a grate set up and a fire lit underneath it and was making porridge. She said, well, the most important thing is to eat, and everybody must eat. But it hadn't occurred to us that to eat, what I mean is, you just didn't seem to think food was necessary. There was just so much happening around you, it's just too much to take in.
Once the organisation started to get into action, as it were, did they provide any special care for women and children?
Yes. In the hydro, people started to... they started congregating around the hydro. They had, as I say, they had communication with radio communication. And, of course, they were living in a group there, so they started looking after one another. And people originally sort of were thinking of how we were going to sort of get water and food and how to sort of clean up and look ahead, I suppose. And then, yes, I suppose it would be somewhere about the middle of the midday that search and rescue would have made contact with the area.
Was a decision made at that time that women and children could be removed from the area?
Yes. Helicopters started coming in later in the afternoon, and their first priority was children and the elderly, and they flew them out. And those that were able to walk, they could walk out as far as they could go and would be picked up further down the road. But most people, a lot of them were flown out. But once again, we were on the other side of the Nangahua River, and the population on our side of the river seemed to be forgotten. Civil Defence turned up then and told us that we weren't allowed to stay. It was getting late by this time, and we then were told that we had to walk down to the railway line, and we would be met. This was heading towards Reefton, but we had to go over a large slip out of the area, and it turned out there was about 50 people left in the Nangahua that hadn't been picked up or helicoptered out.
So by the end of the day, even those of you who thought you'd been forgotten had basically been evacuated from the area?
We were just told, a civil defence came out, and Warren and I were quite happy to stay. We were just picking up our house and thought we would stay, but they told us that we had to go and nobody was allowed to stay. And by this time it was getting dark, so we were told to go down the railway line. As we walked down the railway line, we met all these other people from the southern side of the Nangahua River also walking there. And there were three elderly people that had to be sort of lifted and helped over these slips. We only had one torch between us, which we would, or two or three torches perhaps amongst 50 people, which you'd sort of negotiate a rough part, and then you'd hand the torch back to somebody else so that they could see where they were going.
Was there a feeling of chaos or disorder?
Some people were a wee bit panicky because once again there was earthquakes coming along and the hills were slipping. And I suppose when you're younger, things are more of an adventure than when you're older. And we weren't terribly old at the time.
Ruth, you can still see, of course, the scars physically on the hillsides and around the country in that area, can't you?
Yes.
What about the town and the people itself? Did that earthquake have a long-term effect on a Nangahua settlement itself?
Oh, yes. We were a two-teacher school. No, it could have been a three-teacher school, I think. And we immediately lost so much of the population that it became a... the school numbers dropped tremendously.
Why did people not come back?
Well, if you were in the Ministry of Works and Hydro and whatnot, the houses were damaged. And so people, you weren't allowed back to Nangahua until 4 weeks after the earthquake. We were literally told, you know, no men were allowed to come in and look at farms and care for their stock. But for, other than that, the women weren't allowed to come back for a month.
In a small place like that, there are always characters and identities, aren't there? Are there any stories about people who, during the earthquake, sort of enhance their reputation as characters or identities?
I remember my husband was working with the power board after the earthquake, because there really wasn't anything that you could do at home on the farm. His father came daily to look after the stock. They would just come in and out daily. And so my husband thought, well, he might as well make himself useful. So he worked with the power board, and he said that they were up a pole one particular time, and they could see this earthquake. You know, they heard the earthquake and they could sort of see it coming through. And the men, one of them in particular, was quite pleased that Warren had stayed and held his ladder, because he did everybody else just abandoned him. They didn't want to be round the power pole in case it fell down. So I suppose when we first got out of bed on that morning and met all the locals at the crossroads, standing around their valet heater with their pyjamas and nice attire and coolers, etc., it did seem quite humorous. Everybody was sort of passing around the alcohol, and everybody had a wee sip and would pass it on. I suppose that was quite humorous.